Hello and welcome to this week's dialect. Hello to all and welcome to Dialect. It's brought to you by the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to all our listeners in Bristol, not only them, but also to our listeners on Preston FM on 103.2, and also to our listeners in Swindon, and not forgetting, of course, Radio Verulam in St Albans. So this week on the show, my guest is Philip Lyons, a published poet and a presenter on BCFM, who was commissioned by Bristol University to write a piece for their 2009 centenary. Anthea Page presents part two of her interview with an Israeli anarchist, and Tony Gosling explains the Avon Valley Railway for us. Tim Burrows will be joining us later on with some poetry, and as always, we have the next instalment of Treasure Island and a Watson Guide, courtesy of Jeff. My name is John Peters Coleman. It's my pleasure to introduce Phil Lyons to the studio. Hello.
Hello.
So you are a poet?
I am, John, indeed, yes.
Okay. Is that first and foremost how you define yourself as a person?
In my ideal world, yes, but because poetry doesn't actually make any money, or certainly doesn't make money for the likes of me, I do various other things as well. I have a day job, and also I present a radio show in my spare time on BCFM.
Okay, so some of our listeners might recognise your voice. What show do you present?
I present the Country Music Show every Thursday evening between 8 and 9 o'clock. So if you tune in on a Thursday evening, then you may well hear my voice.
Okay. What is it you like particularly about country and western music that, you know, moves you to have that as your favourite genre?
It's a very good question, actually. I think one of the things is that country music songs tend to tell stories, and I love stories in all their various forms. But also there's a kind of emotional honesty about country music at its best. So people sing about real feelings, real experiences, and with a kind of honesty that you don't necessarily find in other forms of popular music.
Okay, so does that tie in sort of with where your poetry is coming from? Would that also be a handy description for what you want
yes,
to come across in
yes.
your poetry?
No, it does, very much so. I mean, I think I aspire to write the kind of poetry that might appeal to people who also like country music, although I don't want to put off anyone who doesn't like country music by saying that. But I also aspire to the same kind of emotional honesty. And again, in my ideal world, I would be a country music singer-songwriter, but I can't sing and I can't play a musical instrument, so poetry is the next best thing for me.
You could always be a lyricist for an artist.
Well, I've fancied that sometimes, and sometimes people have commented, because I use rhyme and meter a lot, so there is a kind of musical quality to some of the poems I write. I've said, have you ever thought about songwriting? But I've never yet met the right person. I'm like Bernie Taupin in search of an Elton John, I think, if that's not too archaic a reference.
Yeah. There's a balding geography teacher out there somewhere
yes.
Which is what Elton John would look like were it not for the fake hair, who's in search of you.
Right, yes. Maybe he will find me through this radio programme.
Maybe he will. If you're listening, please get in touch. So tell me a little bit about what you've also been doing with your poetry, because I understand you have teach creative writing in sort of creative writing groups, and also you've taught in universities and prisons as well.
Yes, I've been around, mainly in Bristol, but I started out teaching American literature classes in what's called the lifelong learning part of the university, and from there sort of branched out a bit, and particularly as I got more confidence about running creative writing workshops, got very interested in using them in what you might call therapeutic settings. So I worked in a psychiatric hospital for a few years as a healthcare assistant, and through that found the opportunity to run creative writing groups there. So I'm very interested in the way that writing can also help people feel better about themselves or help them to express themselves better.
Okay.
Yeah, doing that on and off for many years now.
We'll come back to that in a second. Would you care to give us a little taste of your poetry?
Oh, absolutely. I'd love to. And I thought I'd read you this poem because it sort of links my passion for country music with my passion for poetry. And it's a kind of fantasy poem, really, about going to Texas in my mind, if not in reality. And it's called Country and Western. Tonight I'm putting on my cowboy boots and going back to Texas for a while. The prairies where a cowboy has his roots. I'll lie beneath the stars and smoke cheroots. This terraced house I live in cramps my style. My sweetheart doesn't understand. She sighs and tells me everything I need's at home. She's frightened of the distance in my eyes. But I see open plains and endless skies, and nothing else will still this urge to roam. I'll only be away a month or two. You probably won't notice I've been gone, but don't come looking for me if you do. I'm going where a cowboy can be blue. It's something cowboys have to do alone.
I like that. There's a sort of modesty in contained within that, along with the passion, I think.
Thank you.
Tell me a little bit about what it's like to teach in a prison. Are they particularly receptive to the therapeutic effects of poetry? Obviously, you picture hardened crims looking like, you know, Lenny McLean going.
Well, surprisingly, I didn't actually teach creative writing, I have to be honest. I taught various other subjects, although I did see examples of prisoners writing. And prison inmates are often quite sentimental in what they write because, actually, believe it or not, inside most hardened criminals, there's actually a very sensitive person trapped inside. But what I did find from teaching in prisons was, for a start, the kind of weird otherworldliness of it. The fact that I used to live round the corner from Hawfield Prison in Bristol and yet found myself working there. And once you go through the prison gates, you're in another world entirely, quite separate really from the world around it. And I found that fascinating. I also found that after I left, I lost my job there after about a year because of cuts in funding for prison education. That was when I started to write about it.
Okay, I'm interested to ask, I mean, do you find people think that of poetry is a very solitary pursuit, but I mean, how do you sort of meet and socialise people through your poetry? Do you find that happens? Or?
Well, I'm in a writing group myself, and we meet once a month. But also, I think there is something essentially social about poetry, although you may write on your own. It's about a form of communication. And most of my poetry is about relationships between myself and other people. And so it is an attempt to sort of connect, I guess, okay. Is a way of putting
it. Let's move on to your book now. What is the broad theme for how you collected the poems that you're going to put in this book?
Well, really, it's kind of, you could see it as a story of the last 30 years of my life, because although I've published a couple of pamphlets before, this is my first full-length collection, and the poems date back over 30 years.
Okay.
But they've been put together in a way that kind of tells a story but not in a chronological order.
And how did it transpire that you got the deal with the publisher?
Well, that was very fortunate, actually. I've known the publisher for some years, and we worked together years ago, but she asked me to judge a poetry competition for their website called Poetry Space. And I judged that about just over a year ago. And as a result of that, she asked me if I'd be interested in submitting a collection. And I just happened to have one lying around, as it were,
right,
waiting for a publisher. And although I have rearranged the order of the poems a bit, it was essentially the poems that I had waiting to find a publisher who was interested.
Have you managed to get it into any local bookshops?
No, but Amazon.co.uk have it available, and the Poetry Space website itself.
Okay, poetryspace.co.uk.
Yeah, that's the one.
Okay, and people can find you under the name Philip with one L, is that
Philip
right?
with one L, yeah. Lyons, L-Y-O-N-S.
Philip Lyons. Well, thank you very much for coming in and sharing your poetry with us, and hopefully we'll hear some more of your poetry in the coming weeks.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for having me on the show, John.
And I was thinking about you guys yesterday. I'd been here three times before, and I think I understand a little bit how you feel about some things. It's none of my business how you feel about some other things. And I don't give a damn how you feel about some other things. But anyway, I tried to put myself in your place, and I believe this is the way that I would feel about San Quentin. San Quentin, you've been living hell to me. You called at me since 1963. I've seen them come and go, and I've seen them die. And long ago I stopped asking why. San Quentin, I hate every inch of you. You've cut me and you've scarred me through and through. And I'll walk out a wiser, weaker man. Mr. Congressman, why can't you understand? What good do you think you do? Do you think that I'll be different when you're through? You bend my heart and mind and you warp my soul. Your stone walls turn my blood a little cold. San Quentin, may you rot and burn in hell. May your walls fall and may I live to tell. May all the world forget you ever stood. And the whole world will regret you did no good. San Quentin, you've been living hell to me.
Bristol has been blessed this week by the presence of a distinguished visitor. She's staying in the east of the city, in Bitton, in a shed, on the Avon Valley Railway. Designed in the 1930s, the Black Five is considered to be one of the greatest pieces of steam engineering in the world. Now you know, and were so successful that through the middle decades of the 20th century, they built nearly 850 Black Fives. So there are more than one of them. Dialect's Tony Gosling watched the steam engine in action and asked Avon Valley guard Alan Hyerson all about the beastie.
My name's Alan Hyerson. I'm a guard in the Avon Valley Railway Heritage Trust. We run over part of the old Midland Railway between Mangotsfield and Bath. Our line is 2 miles long, and this weekend, Saturday and Sunday, the 15th and 16th of October, we have two guest engines and we're running an intensive service of passenger and goods trains for enthusiasts.
Now, before you tell us about this incredible Black Five you've got, is there any hope that you'll extend this track beyond the 2 miles? Because it's quite short, isn't it, really?
It is relatively short at the moment, about 2.25 miles end to end. We would dearly love to be able to extend towards Bath. What we are thinking of trying to do is, subject to all the necessary planning permissions, is extend to somewhere near the park and ride facility near Newbridge, just on the outskirts of Bath. I think it's still a long way in the future.
Anyway, what about the Black Five? Tell us about it. It's a beautiful looking engine. We just heard it steam off there.
The Black Five was the name of a class of locomotives introduced by the London, Midland and Scottish Railway as a general purpose mixed traffic locomotive, equally at home on passenger trains, goods trains, parcel trains, branch local trains. There were 840 of them built. The LMS Railway designed them, although they didn't always build them all because they needed so many in such a short time. And this particular example was built by Armstrong Whitworth, a big engineering firm in Newcastle. The class was spread over most of the country. They could be seen anywhere from Wick and Thurso in Scotland to the south coast at Bournemouth. And many of them used to come through this line, travel on this line in their heyday, up until 1966, when the line closed to passenger traffic and steam virtually disappeared.
When were they first introduced, the Black Fives, then?
1935 or 6.
They were running right through the Second World War.
Yes, they've been described by more than one commentator as an engine that won the war, being so useful for moving goods, ammunition, government stores, many things like that.
When it pulled out just then, it seems very, actually relatively quiet and very powerful and smooth. So what was it about the engineering that was so good about this particular engine?
The steam locomotive is essentially, despite its size, is actually a fairly simple affair. By about the 1930s, steam locomotive development had nearly run its course, and by the time the Black Fives were designed and built, there wasn't really much more that could be done to improve the steam locomotive design. There were some experiments, but by and large, what you ended up with in the 1930s is what virtually ran until the end of steam in the 1960s.
Now, was it able to do long-distance passenger trains as well? Because you were saying it's very versatile.
Yes, it could. It was certainly, in this part of the world, it worked from Bristol to Birmingham, Derby, Sheffield, the expresses that used to run that way. It used to run through Bitton Station on the Pines Express. It used to work them between Bath and Birmingham, Birmingham and Bath. And they used to work south of Bath on the Somerset and Dorset line to Bournemouth. And when I say they used to work it, I mean it could have been any one of the 840 locomotives that were actually built to this design.
So if anyone wants to come and see the Black Five down at Bitton over the next couple of weekends, when is it off? Because we need to know when's the last day we can come and see it.
Well, this Saturday and Sunday, we're having a big weekend. The Black Five will be working passenger and goods trains. We have another visiting locomotive, a Great Western pannier tank locomotive, as well as two of our own locomotives. That will be an intensive service of trains. And on Wednesday the 19th, there is opportunity to see the Black Five. It's running our normal timetable A, which is 11 o'clock the first train and 4 o'clock the last train. And then the following Sunday, the 23rd, it will also be running our normal timetable A train, which is 11 o'clock from Bitton the first train and 4 o'clock the last train.
And where's its home? Where's it going to go back to when she finishes her time here?
It's normally kept on the Watercress line. That's the marketing name for the Mid-Hants Railway. And they are based at Arlesford in Hampshire, just north of Winchester, which is about 80 miles away. So it has cost quite a little bit to get it here and back.
Yep. I find it incredible that even in this day and age, that engines like that are brought by road. One would have thought that it's actually surely easier to drive it along the old British rail lines and then onto your lines.
That would be the case if we were actually connected to the British Railways network, but unfortunately we're not. So everything that has to come here has to come in and go out by road. The Avon Valley Railway runs from Bitton to Oldham Common and Bitton to Avon Riverside. Bitton Station is on the A431 between Bristol and Bath. It's about 2 miles north of Keynsham. If anyone wants to come by train to Keynsham, they can buy a through ticket from any First Great Western staffed station, and there is a free bus service from Keynsham to Bitton to connect with our trains.
And what days does that bus service run?
That's running on Saturday the 15th and Sunday the 16th.
Alan Hyson there from the Avon Valley Railway in Bitton, talking to Dialect's Tony Gosling. As Alan said there, that you heard, you can get tickets today from all manned British rail stations, which include the free bus from Keynsham for the weekend steam gala. And you'll find the old Bitton station on the A431 between Bristol and Bath. And in case you want lunch or fancy a cup of tea and a cake, there is a cafe there too in two old railway carriages. If you remember, last week we played part one of an interview with an Israeli activist who's fighting for the Palestinian cause. And this week we'll hear part two.
My name is Lihi Rothschild. I'm an activist in Boycott From Within and Anarchists Against the Wall, both Israeli groups that are in solidarity and in support of the Palestinian struggle.
Can you tell us what's happening over there? You're Jewish.
Yeah. By heritage and by familial history, if not by faith, and by the privileges that this grant me according to the State of Israel, which privileges the status of Jewish citizens over all other citizens, and namely Palestinians. Only recently, a leaflet has been distributed in high schools in Tel Aviv, warning girls from dating Arabs. And not only that this group that is distributing those leaflets was not scolded by the Israeli parliament, they actually were invited to a meeting over there on Women's Day last year. If all those things that have been happening in any other Western country and were targeting Jews, if, for that matter, PESCO would have refused to employ Jews, just imagine what intentum would have erupted all over England and all over Europe. But the fact that those things happen regularly in Israel is just going unnoted.
Do you think it's because America's behind Israel?
I think definitely the Americans have a lot of responsibility. The Israeli occupation and the Israeli apartheid are certainly made in the USA. The fact that the US gives full diplomatic support to Israel, vetoing any decision, any motion, rises up against it in the Security Council, that it keeps on giving military funding to Israel that amounts to the same funding that it gives to all other world countries put together, $3 billion a year. the fact that it allows Israel to be completely immune to any international criticism certainly plays part in the way the world's treating Israel. Obama's speech to the UN, lately given, the Israeli foreign minister, Avigdor Lieberman, who's an extremist right-wing, said that he would have signed on every word. So that just comes to show you how much support Israel is getting from the US.
What about the press coverage of what's happening? What is the press like in Israel, the media?
The media in Israel is very, very complicit with the government and with the regime. In general, all of the big newspapers and all of the television and radio networks are very Zionist. All of them report straight from the offices of the IDF spokesperson and the police spokesperson. And aside from a scarce few brave reporters that write critical articles and try to bring out some different points of views and to actually report facts, then the Israeli media doesn't do any sort of job in covering what's really happening. The only reason to actually read the Israeli media is in order to see the way that they're covering what's happening and to compare it with the things that are actually happening in the field.
As an activist, you've had your email account hacked.
All Israeli activists are being targeted by the regime. Most of us have our phones listened to, as we know from like some inner sources. I had my email account hacked several times this year. I had my apartment raided by the Israeli police. I had been interrogated by a secret police officers, and similar things have happened to many of my friends.
Are you frightened by the events?
I think they're much more frightened than we are. The fact that they keep on using all those measures against us just means that they're terrified by our activities, and the pressure that they're trying to employ means that we're doing something very, very right.
You're young and you've got other activists who are young people. Is it the older people who accept the situation more than the young people over there?
I don't think so. The ages in our group vary from 17 to 70. We have activists of all age groups, and many of us are in our 20s, but there are many who are in their 30s, and there are many who are older than that. There are many people that are past 40 and are very, very, very involved, both in protests, in the West Bank, in direct action, in the BDS movement, in every sort of activism that I partake in.
Do you go into Palestine?
I go into the occupied territories, usually once a week for the Friday weekly demonstrations of the popular committee in various villages all across the West Bank. I have acquired friends all over those villages, because once you come and meet with people every week, demonstrate with them and stay over with them and spend time with them, obviously enough you end up becoming friends. We have friends in other places, but I also have Palestinian friends inside the 48 territories, and actually as well as some Palestinian refugees living in the UK and in the US and in other places.
How do Palestinians react to Jewish people?
All the reactions that I've encountered from Palestinians to Jewish activists that come to be in solidarity with Palestinians, of Jewish activists that respect the three basic rights of the Palestinians, the right of the refugees and the right of Palestinians living inside 48 and in 67, have been very, very positive, very, very supportive. I've always been welcomed in most of the villages in which I came to protest. All the people opened their houses and their hearts to us, and have been very, very welcoming and very, very supportive. There are cases in which even the Palestinian people that we come to be in solidarity with end up protecting us and hiding us. Because in a village such as Nabi Salah, for instance, in which there are weekly demonstrations every Friday, in many cases the Israeli army is actually targeting the Israeli activists that are coming down to protest. And we end up hiding in the houses in order not to be caught by the army, because they're trying to place restraining orders and prevent us from coming again to the village. And as for the Palestinians, they can just arrest them at any other time of the day or during the night. I actually had this one very ridiculous incident in which we were hiding in a small room in a basement of one of the houses of the village, and a soldier came into the house and asked the house owner, are there any Jews in the house? And she told him no, and he said, "Are you sure?" And she said, "Yes." And he said, "What's in that room?" Probably pointing at the basement in which we were hiding. And she said, "Oh, there's nothing in there." And he said, "All right." And he left the house. And then they threw in a tear gas canister into the room in which we were hiding. Luckily enough, one of the activists had very, very strong instincts and closed the window before the canister exploded.
Tell us about the political situation in Israel. Is it becoming more right-wing?
Yeah, and in the last few years, the state has been becoming more and more extremist to the right. And the fact is that Israel has always been a state of apartheid, a state of oppression, a state of discrimination and occupation. Palestinians have always been oppressed and discriminated, and many measures of persecution have been taken against them. But in the last few years, Israel is turning more and more fascist and more extremist. Many measures that have once been deployed every once in a while are now becoming more and more frequent. In the name of security, everything can be done without any bit of criticism by the public, by the media, or by anyone but the small group of radical left activists.
Does the fascism produce a reaction in Israel by the people?
It actually seems like most people support it. Current surveys in high school students and youngsters have actually shown that most people in these age groups believe that a strong regime is more important than a democratic regime.
Is that because of security? They feel insecure?
I don't think they feel insecure, but they were brainwashed to believe that in the name of security, everything is justified. And as soon as the word security is being used, then it just justifies everything.
What about the Palestinians? Is there any hope for their country or not? Or would it get worse?
I believe there is hope for the Palestinians, and for that reason I'm part of the BDS campaign. I believe that there is a Palestinian call issued in 2005 for boycott, divestment and sanctions against Israel. It was signed by 170 civil society Palestinian organizations of Palestinians inside 67, of Palestinians inside 48, and of Palestinian organization of refugees from the diaspora. And I believe that this call for external pressure against the state of Israel, the main hope for the Palestinian struggle these days, the more Israel will pay a price for the occupation and the apartheid, the more the world will demand answer and will stop allowing this sort of impunity that's been giving to Israel until now, the higher are the chances that some things will end up changing.
If people across the world are listening to this, or people out there on the internet hear about this message, can they join your organisation on the internet?
People cannot join Boycott From Within unless they're Israeli citizens. But what they can do is join the BDS movement. There are groups promoting the BDS campaign all over the world, here in the UK as well, and in almost every other country. There are groups for justice for Palestine. There is the Palestine Solidarity Campaign. There are BDS groups, and all they need to do is Google BDS and the local area in which they're placed, and they'll find a group that they can join. They're obviously welcome to come on our website and express their support. The website would be boycottisrael.info, or as well as go on the Anarchist Against the Wall website. They're also more than welcome to leave their donation for the legal costs of our struggle and the Palestinian struggle, as both are covered by the group.
Thank you very much to the Israeli activists concerned, and also to Anthea Page, of course. I'd like to welcome Tony Gosling to the studio. He's here to give us a bit of an update with what is going on in the amateur dramatics circle.
Hi, John. Yeah, one of the things always to think of when it comes to amateur dramatics is the demise of the Little Theatre, which has now been built over in Colson Street back in the 1980s. The local amateur dramatic scene in the city was promised by the City Council they were going to close the Little Theatre on Colson Street and refurbish it, but then it never reopened. And now the building's been sold and has all been redeveloped by the university, which is a great pity because there isn't really a place where you can regularly go and see amateur dramatic performances in the city centre anymore after that. So naughty, naughty City Council. But anyway, there's lots of places around the city, and in fact one or two more central venues that AmDram's happening, and it's all organised, pretty much coordinated by the Avon Association of Drama, whose monthly magazine Prompt is really the bible of all the Amdram stuff that's going on in the city, and there's a tremendous amount as we come up to the season for pantomime. And I would suggest try and get to see at least one of the pantomimes that's going on in the run-up to Christmas, November and December.
Okay.
The website for them is avondrama.org.uk, and you can talk to Anne Alpin if you want to get on their mailing list. I think it's something like £5 a year on 01454 228 243. I'll give that number again at the end. But let's have a look then at some of the upcoming performances in October and November. The 17th, 18th, 24th and 25th of October, we've got a little French variety show and Musketeer, which is a double bill of variety performed by adults and a one-act play by the junior section. This is The Stage Lights at Wesley Memorial Church Hall in St George. That's 7:30 on the Saturdays and 2 o'clock on the Sundays. Their website is thestagelights.co.uk. Moving on through October, there's Heidi High, which is on from the 19th to the 21st down in Clevedon.
And it's a bit of an 80s throwback, isn't it?
Well, it is. There's quite a lot of that. And, you know, this is the nice thing about Amdram, is people just have a discussion about what their next performance is going to be. And it's whatever the performers fancy for the next thing. And there is obviously quite a lot of 80s interest at the moment. The Clevedon Players, that's at Prince's Hall, Prince's Road, Clevedon, at 7:45. And again, the dates are from the 19th to the 21st. Of October. In November, we've got one of the performances which particularly piqued my interest was Who Killed the Vicar by Chris Martin, the Chaps Drama Group. That's at Wick Village Hall at 7 o'clock for 7:30, which includes a light supper. Their phone number's 0117 956 0803.
A light supper which hopefully people will survive.
And really the last one before the panto season kicks in is towards the end of November. That's An Ideal Husband, 23rd to the 28th of November, and that is by Oscar Wilde. And that's the Tickenham Drama Group at Tickenham Village Hall, 7:30 between those dates. That's over 5 days. And they're on 01275 852-663. And also there's a Twice Nightly, Two Plays, One Murder and Twice the Fun at Westbury Park Church Hall. That's Wednesday the 23rd to Saturday the 26th of November. And just a reminder of the website for prompt again, it's avondrama.org.uk. And if you want to get their listings magazine, which comes out every month, as I said, contact Anne Alpin on 01454 228 243.
All right, well, plenty of variety there for us to get our heads around. So, Tony Gosling, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Time for Treasure Island, read by Malcolm Grieve.
Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. Part 5, My Sea Adventure. Chapter 23, The Ebb Tide Runs. The Coracle, as I had ample reason to know before I was done with it, was a very safe boat for a person of my height and weight, both buoyant and clever in a seaway. But she was the most cross-grained, lopsided craft to manage. Do as you pleased, she always made more leeway than anything else, and turning round and round was the manoeuvre she was best at. Even Ben Gunn himself had admitted that she was a queer to handle till you know her way. Certainly I did not know her way. She turned in every direction but the one I was bound to go. The most part of the time we were broadside on, and I am very sure I never should have made the ship at all but for the tide. By good fortune, paddle as I pleased, the tide was still sweeping me down. and there lay the Hispaniola right in the fairway, hardly to be missed. First, she loomed before me like a blot of something yet blacker than the darkness. Then her spars and hull began to take shape, and the next moment, as it seemed, for the farther I went, the brisker grew the current of the ebb. I was alongside her hawser and had laid hold. The hawser was taut as a bowstring, so strong she pulled upon her anchor. All around the hull in the blackness, the rippling current bubbled and chattered like a little mountain stream. One cut with my sea gully, and the Hispaniola would go humming down the tide. So far, so good. But it next occurred to my recollection that a taut hawser suddenly cut is a thing as dangerous as a kicking horse. 10 to 1 if I was so foolhardy as to cut the Hispaniola from her anchor, I and the coracle would be knocked clean out of the water. This brought me to a full stop. And if fortune had not again particularly favoured me, I should have had to abandon my design. But the light airs which had begun blowing from the southeast and south had hauled around after nightfall into the southwest. Just while I was meditating, a puff came, caught the Hispaniola and forced her up into the current. And to my great joy, I felt the hawser slacken in my grasp, and the hand by which I held it dip for a second under the water. With that I made my mind up, took out my gully, opened it with my teeth, and cut one strand after another, till the vessel only swung by two. Then I lay quiet, waiting to sever these last when the strain should be more lightened by a breath of wind. All this time, I had heard the sound of loud voices from the cabin, but to say truth, my mind had been so entirely taken up with other thoughts that I had scarcely given ear. Now, however, when I had nothing else to do, I began to pay more heed. One I recognised for the coxswain's, Israel Hands, that had been Flint's gunner in former days. The other was, of course, my friend of the red nightcap. Both men were plainly the worse of drink, and they were still drinking, for even while I was listening, one of them with a drunken cry opened the stern window and threw out something, which I divined to be an empty bottle. But they were not only tipsy, it was plain that they were furiously angry. Oaths flew like hailstones, and every now and then there came forth such an explosion as I thought was sure to end in blows. But each time the quarrel passed off, and the voices grumbled lower for a while, until the next crisis came, and in its turn passed away without result. On shore, I could see the glow of the great campfire burning warmly through the shoreside trees. Someone was singing, a dull, old, droning sailor's song with a droop and a quaver at the end of every verse, and seemingly no end to it at all but the patience of the singer. I had heard it on the voyage more than once, and remembered these words. But one man off her crew alive had put to sea with 75. And I thought it was a ditty rather too dolefully appropriate for a company that had met such cruel losses in the morning. But indeed, from what I saw, all these buccaneers were as callous as the sea they sailed on. At last the breeze came. The schooner sidled and drew nearer in the dark. I felt the hawser slacken once more, and with a good, tough effort, cut the last fibres through. The breeze had but little action on the coracle, and I was almost instantly swept against the bows of the Hispaniola. At the same time, the schooner began to turn upon her heel, spinning slowly end to end across the current. I wrought like a fiend, for I expected every moment to be swamped, and since I found I could not push the coracle directly off, I now shoved straight astern. At length I was clear of my dangerous neighbour, and just as I gave the last impulsion, my hands came across a light cord that was trailing overboard across the starn bulwarks. Instantly I grasped it. Why I should have done so, I can hardly say. It was at first mere instinct, but once I had it in my hands and found it fast, curiosity began to get the upper hand, and I determined I should have one look through the cabin window. I pulled in hand over hand on the cord, and when I judged myself near enough, rose at infinite risk to about half my height, and thus commanded the roof and a slice of the interior of the cabin. By this time the schooner and her little consort were gliding pretty swiftly through the water. Indeed, we had already fetched up level with the campfire. The ship was talking, as sailors say, loudly, treading the innumerable ripples with an incessant weltering splash. And until I got my eye above the windowsill, I could not comprehend why the watchman had taken no alarm. One glance, however, was sufficient, and it was only one glance that I durst take from that unsteady skiff. It showed me Hans and his companion locked together in a deadly wrestle, each with a hand upon the other's throat. I dropped on the thwart again, none too soon, for I was near overboard. I could see nothing for the moment but these two furious, encrimsoned faces swaying together under the smoky lamp, and I shut my eyes to let them grow once more familiar with the darkness. The endless ballad had come to an end at last, and the whole diminished company around the campfire had broken into the chorus that I had heard so often. 15 men on a dead man's chest, yo-ho-ho and a bottle of rum. Drink and the devil had done for the rest, yo-ho-ho and a bottle of rum. I was just thinking how busy drink and the devil were at that very moment in the cabin of the Hispaniola, when I was surprised by a sudden lurch of the coracle. At the same moment she yawed sharply and seemed to change course. The speed in the meantime had strangely increased. I opened my eyes at once. All around me were little ripples combing over with a sharp bristling sound and slightly phosphorescent. The Hispaniola herself, a few yards in whose wake I was still being whirled along, seemed to stagger in her course, and I saw her spars toss a little against the blackness of the night. Nay, as I looked longer, I made sure she also was wheeling to the southward. I glanced over my shoulder, and my heart jumped against my ribs. There, right behind me, was the glow of the campfire. The current had turned at right angles, sweeping round along with it the tall schooner and the little dancing coracle. Ever quickening, ever bubbling higher, ever muttering louder, it went spinning through the narrows for the open sea. Suddenly the schooner in front of me gave a violent yaw, turning perhaps through 20 degrees, and almost at the same moment one shout followed another from on board. I could hear feet pounding on the companion ladder, and I knew that the two drunkards had at last been interrupted in their quarrel and awakened to a sense of their disaster. I lay down flat in the bottom of that wretched skiff and devoutly recommended my spirit to its maker. At the end of the straits, I made sure we must fall into some bar of raging breakers where all my troubles would be ended speedily. And though I could perhaps bear to die, I could not bear to look upon my fate as it approached. So I must have lain for hours, continually beaten to and fro upon the billows, now and again wetted with flying sprays, and never ceasing to expect death at the next plunge. Gradually weariness grew upon me, a numbness, an occasional stupor fell upon my mind even in the midst of these terrors, until sleep at last supervened, and in my sea-tossed coracle I lay and dreamed of home and the old Admiral Benbow.
That was Treasure Island, read by Malcolm Grieve. Excellent. Well, at this juncture, it's normally time for some poetry from Tim Burrows, and the man himself is indeed here. Hello.
Hi.
But we've not got poetry so much this week. What have we got?
Well, I brought a guitar and a keyboards player to do a song called Another Voice is Silent, which is it's an epitaph for any singer that dies, as a friend, local friend, singer-songwriter, Dave Totterdale, recently died. But this one I also wrote when Johnny Cash died, and I've recently revamped it.
Okay.
And Chris Hales here is also a Johnny Cash fan, so it's...
Hail Chris.
Hi.
How long have you known this man?
Oh, about 10 years now. Met in my local pub, really. I used to go there and listen to really good music that the landlord put on.
Yeah.
And now and then, in the middle of the week, Tim would turn up with his snare drum, playing with some bluegrass players. And I just grew from there, really, and I got to know his songs, and they tell a story, and they're very poignant, some of them are very funny, others as well. So, yeah, it's a great pleasure playing with him.
So, and how long have you been playing your piano?
I'm off and on since I was about seven, but didn't practice as much probably as I should have done, as we all.
Yeah, were you a fan of Johnny Cash?
Oh, great, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so that's
all the stuff, even the old stuff and the stuff with the trumpets and the... Ring of Fire.
And the religious hallelujah songs and
yeah, I love
the whole lot.
Yeah.
Cool. So your love of Johnny Cash mutually drew you together to
play. Yeah.
Yeah, that's
cool. Okay, well, let's hear it.
Another voice is silent. Another singer gone, no more words to take us through the night, take us through till dawn. A man who rode the railways across the dusty plain, sang his song in prison.
Chris Hale, thank you very much to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And no Jeff himself, I'm afraid, for the What's On Guide, but he has sent his script in, so here it is. Hello, this is Jeff with the What's On Guide from Dialect, he says. Starting with Friday the 21st of October, Poodles of Doom will be performing at the Reckless Engineer in Temple Gate, Bristol. The entry is free, and the gig starts at around 9 p.m. Also on the 21st of October, Guns to Roses will be performing at the Victoria, which is at 88 Victoria Road, Swindon. Tickets are £6 in advance and doors open at 8pm. Also on that night, Cap Down, the 90s Scarcore band, are playing at the Fleece. On to the Song of the Week, and I present Hollywood Rose. This group formed in 1983 and consisted of Axl Rose, Izzy Stradlin, Chris Weber and Johnny Christ. In 1984, they recorded a 5-song demo, which included this song, Killing Time. Enjoyed that. That was Hollywood Rose with Killing Time. It's worth noting that this was a forerunner group for what would eventually become Guns N' Roses. On Saturday, 22nd of October, Purple Zeppelin will be performing material by Deep Purple and Led Zeppelin, and they'll be performing at the Victoria in 88 Victoria Road, Swindon. Tickets are £6 in advance, and the doors open at 8pm. Also worth noting, Merciless Precision are also playing on the 22nd of October. Check it out. Finally, on Sunday, the 23rd of October, Flash Harry will be performing at the Coronation Tap in Sion Place, Bristol. Entry is £3 on the door, and the gig starts at 4pm. That's all from Jeff, he says. Thanks for listening, and have a great week. Take care, and goodbye. Well, that's all from Dialect this week. Thank you very much to our studio guest, the poet Philip Lyons. Remember to check out poetryspace.co.uk. Features all by Tony Gosling and Anthea Page, and Malcolm Grieve read another episode of Treasure Island. Tim Burrows sang us a song, along with his mate Chris, who played the keyboards. Jess Sparks wrote the What's On Guide, and I read it. The studio engineer was Michael Noyce, and the producer was Michaela Dennis. Thank you very much to Anthea Page for some wonderful cake. That's goodbye from me, John Peters Coleman. See you next week. Goodbye. Thank you.
now you talk like all you want what we had before. Well, I'm not listening anymore. Telegram, telephone, tell your best friend.